From NPR, it's Latino USA. Immigration remains a hotly debated issue on the current presidential campaign trail. The question is, will 2012 be the election year that breaks with the past and ends hardline U.S. immigration policies?
2012 will mark the year where we grappled with the impact of the recession on the Latino population writ large. We went along for 20 years telling ourselves that there was this inexorable flood of people coming from Mexico to the United States. And it turned out not to be true.
On this week's show, a conversation with veteran journalist and author Roberto Suro about Latinos in America in 2012.
I say watch for the rise of the wise Latina. Native-born females, 17 to 25, going to college.
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, but first, las noticias. The process is well on its way to determining who will run against President Obama in November. Iowa and New Hampshire are in the rear view. South Carolina is now front and center. But are these states as crucial as they're made out to be, and where do Latino voters fit in? Angelo Falcon joins us now. He's the president of the National Institute for Latino Policy. Angelo, thanks for coming back to Latino USA.
Yeah, it's always nice to be here.
So, Angelo, big news this week with the announcement that Cecilia Muñoz, the highest-ranking Latina in the Obama administration, was promoted to the head of the Domestic Policy Council. What do you see behind this move from the Obama administration?
In the Latino community, there's a lot of discontent in terms of the Obama administration, especially around the issue of immigration, which is basically her portfolio, and it remains her portfolio in this position. And also, you know, the administration also has been criticized for not having enough women in high positions. So I think she fits the bill and those grounds, and Obama's fighting for his political life in terms of staying in the White House. So, you know, it fits in very nicely, and I hope that she'll continue this at a higher level, and that it'll intensify our community's relationship to the administration.
So in terms of the Democrats, some movement around the Latino issue, what about in terms of the Republicans? Because, you know, there are a lot of people who say, a lot of analysts who say, you know, when you're talking about a Latino electorate that is growing, and you think about the primaries that are going on in places like Iowa, then New Hampshire, looking towards South Carolina, it's not until you get to Florida, which then you finally start getting a sense of the presence of the Latino electorate.
Right.
So what do you think about this?
Well, my sense is, you know, again, maybe this is conspiratorial. I have a theory that the Obama administration has been paying the Republican candidates to help them mobilize the Latino community for his election, because I can't believe the kinds of things that were coming out of these debates in terms of the Latino community. I mean, they have this kind of like automatic on and off switch in their brains where you say Latino and they go, oh, illegal immigration. I would love to see party competition over the Latino vote. But what I'm finding is that that's not the case. We just have the whole thing in Arizona, Alabama, kind of almost like terrorism against our community, Republican party driven. You have, for example, the case over in Arizona about Mexican American Studies program, Republican driven. We just had Marco Rubio, who, for example, he's a Cuban senator who was trying to block the appointment of Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. So this is the person that they're identifying as maybe their key to get into the Latino community has an awful track record dealing with Latinos.
You know what happened in terms of Newt Gingrich and the fact that just over the past couple of days, you know, Newt Gingrich went to this, you know, Mexican restaurant for a Latino town hall. This is in New Hampshire. You had Mitt Romney talking pointedly about his family that was born in Mexico. So is this is for you just absolute show?
Well, the thing is that ultimately the policies that they're presenting are, I consider, detrimental to the Latino community at this point. They're counting on the idea that somehow there's this very large Latino middle class that's conservative. It's not there. It's not there. This is a largely poor working class people, lower middle class people at most. I think that they're totally misreading it.
All right, let's come full circle and end up with the Democrats again. Again, President Obama, the fact that he recently changed some immigration rules, stating that it's going to be easier for certain undocumented individuals to apply for a green card. These would be people who are getting married or are a parent of an American citizen. So how significant is this in terms of actually delivering change? Or are we back to where we started, which is a lot of politics?
Well, I think people recognize that the president is hamstrung by the kind of polarization we see in Washington today. First, he said he couldn't do much through executive order and all that. Now we're finding out it turns out he can do things if there's enough pressure put on. So one of the lessons to the Latino community is keep the pressure on. And number two, hopefully these are what at one point they called down payments. Like people talked about the DREAM Act, there's a down payment on a broader immigration strategy. What we have to do now as a community is make sure that the president as candidate makes very concrete commitments if he gets reelected.
Okay, Angelo. Well, we'll have you back to bring us up to date in the next couple of months, I'm sure.
Great. I look forward to it.
Angelo Falcón is the president of the National Institute for Latino Policy in New York. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter. We are LatinoUSA, all one word, and we're back in 30 seconds. That's 30 segundos, so stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. 2012 has arrived. That means that for the next 10 months, every politician, pundit, and political reporter will fill our airwaves with analysis and predictions on which way voters will swing on November 6th. The Latino vote is crucial, but it's also a vote that tends to be elusive when voting as a bloc. Today, we want to take a step back and look at how the Latino community is changing and evolving as an electorate and how that might affect the election come November. To talk about this, we're joined by Roberto Suro, a former Washington Post reporter, a former director of the Pew Hispanic Center, and now a professor of journalism and public policy at the University of Southern California. Welcome back to Latino USA, Roberto.
Great to be with you, Maria.
When you think about 2012 and Latinos, you say that primary on your mind is you see some major shifts that have occurred that a lot of people aren't talking about. What are these shifts that are happening that we need to see in terms of Latinos?
2012 will mark the year where we really grappled with the impact of the recession on the Latino population writ large. I think people will really begin to see how much has changed in the last 5 years. And the Latino recession has longer, you know, it started earlier for Latinos and it's going to last longer. This has been true of every downturn. And it really started with Latinos as soon as the housing market started going south in 2006. We began to see the number of people coming into the country coming down from very high levels and then flatten and then go down. And now we're at a point where we're at net zero pretty much with Mexico, which is extraordinary when you think about it.
So what does that mean? You're saying that
what I'm saying is that we went along for 20 years telling ourselves that there was this inexorable flood of people coming from Mexico to the United States. And it turned out not to be true. There were a lot of people coming from Mexico to the United States under certain conditions. The conditions changed, the flows changed, and they've changed dramatically.
So what are the conditions that have changed?
9% unemployment. And the Mexican economy, to a lot of people's surprise and not getting much attention, has been going along okay the last few years. Mexico's underlying macroeconomic stability and the growth of the labor force and the improvement in the quality of the labor force, the expansion of the middle class that we've seen all over Latin America, big untold story in the United States, the transformation, really, of Latin America has happened in part in Mexico, and it's substantially. So the pressure is reduced. The drawing power of the American economy is much reduced, and we've now are into the fourth or fifth year of pretty substantial law enforcement efforts, continuing on the border and increasing on the interior, which create an impression, if nothing else, and in many cases a reality, of a more hostile environment. So I think you add all those things up, and the fall off has been in low-skilled, young, male, unauthorized Mexicans.
And there are going to be a lot of people, Roberto, who say, well, then that means that for the year 2012, all of these efforts to curtail this illegal immigration, this flood, this sense of people coming and taking over, there will be many people who say, well, that's great then. The future of 2012 means the problem solved.
I mean, it's not that we did it particularly. And like a lot of things, you wouldn't necessarily wish it on yourself. I mean, you wouldn't say, in order to reduce the flow of unauthorized migrants in the United States, what we really need is the worst economic downturn in a lifetime. But it's one of the things that happens. It's one of the small side effects of an economic catastrophe this size is that you reduce the flows. And the other side of this coin is that the population that stayed, and a great many people stayed. I mean, one of the surprises about this last period is how small the number of people who went back to Mexico in the face of this catastrophe and the increased enforcement. People basically sheltered in place. You did not have a big return exodus. If you think of an enforcement strategy that is based on the idea of let's make life uncomfortable enough that people will go home, and in various political leaders and over now going back to the early 1990s have been trying to figure out, well, all right, so they can't get health care, you can't do this, you won't be let to, let's make it so they can't rent houses, let's so they can't work, they can't, you know, it's going to be uncomfortable driving. What do you have to do? One of the things this recession showed us is you're going to have to top that. You have to top 2007, 8, and 9 for the level of pain you're inflicting, because they stayed through that. So the other thing, you could imagine people coming to the conclusion that, okay, that's not going to work because we as a society are not capable of inflicting enough pain to get these people to leave.
But in terms of the future, what does the fact that there's now, you know, a decrease in the number of immigrants from Mexico, there is a stable of people who have stayed and not left, what does all of that mean in terms of what plays out in the future?
You go 5-6 years where the number of young, low-skilled, Spanish-speaking, unauthorized men coming into the community is much decreased. You have more settled communities. The share of households that are married couples goes up. The number of houses that have five guys living in the garages go down. The number of households that now have American citizen children goes up. In all, the communities will mature some. The level of English acquisition will go up. The problems will be more those of settled populations. You know, Los Angeles is a test case for this. It's a place where the migration, the inflow has been down now for almost a decade since it peaked. People went elsewhere because it got so expensive, so the number of new arrivals is fewer. So you get much more attention to schools, much more attention to parks, less attention to the very specific issues of a new immigrant population, worker centers, day laborers. They don't disappear, but the mix changes.
So do you think that one of the big questions in terms of the Latino electorate for 2012 is the question that, okay, now they recognize their power, but they feel frustrated, and so they don't turn out? Is that the big risk of 2012? And if so, how do you what happens if that happens? What is the long-term impact of that?
When you talk about the Latino electorate in presidential politics, the first thing you've got to do is stop talking about the Latino electorate. Here's the problem. It's still true that about two-thirds of Latino voters start out in states that nobody cares about. They're in California, New York, and Texas. If those states are in play, then there's been an earthquake. Latinos, I mean, then everything's up for grabs. there's a lot of the Latino vote that, as a political scientist would say, overdetermined. So you end up with Latinos in a few places that really matter in terms of presidential politics. Florida.
So for 2012, where are those places?
Florida, always. And Florida is a boutique in every way, and Latino voting in Florida is a boutique. I mean, it's the old Cubans, the young Cubans, the old Puerto Ricans, the new Puerto Ricans, and some naturalized South Americans. And then there's the Intermountain West. You know, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona maybe. And differs even within those places. You know, in Nevada, you've got this big contingent of people who were amnestied in the 86 amnesty, who were unionized hotel workers, very blue-collar, very working-class. New Mexico is a whole different animal. That's where you could see the battle playing out. If you live in Los Angeles or New York or Dallas, this election, look down ballot for where your impact's going to be. If you're in Las Vegas or Denver, you could end up playing, you could help decide the vote if things play out that that's the battleground. So there are lots of scenarios where, you know, that limited slice of the Latino electorate all of a sudden becomes crucially important.
So, Roberto, what's the one story that you're kind of keeping your eye on for 2012 that you think is flying under the radar, but that in terms of our country, in terms of Latinos, is one we need to be watching for the future?
This is 2012 and beyond. I say watch for the rise of the wise Latina.
I like that.
That's my prediction.
So are we watching Sonia Sotomayor, or are you
not Sonia Sotomayor at all, no, but what she was thinking about when she gave that much-discussed speech. So when you talk about these larger dynamics we were talking about before, the segment of the population that we're going to start talking about is going to be native-born females, 17 to 25, fluent English speakers who have finished high school and who are going to college. And that will change it's going to change the nature of the Latino family. It's going to change the nature of the economic dynamics in our communities. It'll change the interface, the between the Latino population and Anglo culture will be very different when people think of this population in terms of wise Latinas instead of day laborers. And this is not to put down day laborers, but I'm saying this to dramatize the demographic change, which I think is significant, and also to say our agenda needs to shift. We as much as the rest of the world, have been focused on one very important, very significant issue that's gone unresolved for way too long. But in the meantime, all kinds of other things, mostly involving our children, have gone with too little attention.
Thanks for joining us on Latino USA, Roberto, and for sharing your thoughts about the future.
Oh, always a pleasure to be with a wise Latina.
I'll take that one for 2012. I'll look forward to that.
You're welcome.
Roberto Suro is a professor of journalism and public policy at USC Annenberg. And in a minute, we visit the land where the rainbow gets its colors and volcanoes shake the earth, communing with nature in Guatemala. That's coming up. No se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Latino USA's founding producer, Maria Martin, has lived in Guatemala for the past 10 years, where trembling of the ground is a common occurrence. But as Maria Martin explains, even with the fury of nature, there's something about living in the land of the shaking earth that reminds her just how precious life is and how utterly extraordinary Mother Nature is. This audio essay is part of our ongoing series, Radio Nature, exploring people's connection to nature and the outdoors.
I live in Guatemala because each day I wake up and see the volcano called Agua out my window. As the day goes on, the volcano changes before my eyes. First it's clear against a blue sky, then the clouds roll in and I only see the top of the cone. Then it's totally covered by mist and clouds. By evening, it may reappear. It's almost like a point of focus for meditation, a lesson in mindfulness, as I watch the volcano out the picture window facing the desk where I work. My computer keeping me in touch with the rest of the world, Agua bringing me back to the here and now. To say I feel closer to nature here is something of an understatement. I've had yards and gardens before, for instance. Here mine is small, but so very lush. I especially love the Monja Blanca orchid that my friend Chepe led me to buy in Coban. He passed away 2 years ago, and it seems to bloom without fail on the anniversary of his passing.
Es para mí un gran privilegio poderle saludar con todo mi corazón.
Here, a simple morning greeting from Don Santos the gardener brings a golden light of joy lasting the whole day as he waters the orchids and the other plants that surround me with color.
There was a man who told me he talked to his violets and other flowers. He would say, "How are you today?" So when I go water my plants, I always talk to them as if they were people, and they respond with gratitude. So I always touch the leaves and tell them that I love them.
Above my little casita y jardín, my house and garden, beyond the tiled roofs and the lush green hills, are two other volcanoes, Fuego and Acatenango. Fuego throws up puffs of smoke that range from small to quite impressive to occasional full-blown eruptions. Always a reminder that the earth is a living, breathing, changing creation and that we live at its mercy and its kindness. Nature's fury, as well as its beauty, is often on show here in this land of volcanoes, earthquakes, hurricanes, landslides, and tropical storms. It's one of the dangers facing the journalists I sometimes work with here in Guatemala, like Aníbal Archila, who was killed 2 years ago covering the eruption of the Pacaya volcano. His colleagues sadly reported his death. I first visited the Central American country in 1975 and fell in love. Within its borders are extensive rainforests, monumental ancient Mayan cities, and what Aldous Huxley called the most beautiful lake in the world, the majestic and mysterious Atitlan. Of all this country's natural wonders, I love Atitlan the most. The lake seems to float into the sky, its three towering volcanoes rising from its shores. These giants, San Pedro, Tolimán, and Atitlan, look down into the abyss of this deepest lake in Central America. These days, I see more charter boats on the lake, and sometimes even people on jet skis. But I love the traditional kayaks called cayutes I first saw almost 40 years ago, with a single fisherman having a one-to-one relationship with this lovely body of water and its creatures. On the shores of Atitlan lie at least 12 indigenous villages, its Mayan people struggling to make a living as they always have, recognizing the power of Madre Tierra and the need to nurture Mother Earth. It's said that in Mayan, the word Atitlan means the place where the rainbow gets its colors.
También está aquí el color rojo, es de los insectos, es de la cochinilla. También tenemos
Francisca Hernández Vázquez lives the wonders and the colors of Atitlan every single day. She's the president of a women's weaving collective called Corazón del Lago, Heart of the Lake. They use dyes from fruits and barks and insects to color the textiles they weave in the tiny town of San Juan La Laguna.
La verdad que me siento muy feliz porque estamos cerca del lago, estamos entre muchos árboles.
In truth, I'm happy to live so close to the lake, and it's up to us to value all this nature. It's really so beautiful. I always tell the other ladies of our association, Heart of the Lake, we have to take care of this, so our children and grandchildren don't suffer one day, so they'll have clean water and everything they need.
Es para ayudar más a nuestra familia y aportar un poquito en el desarrollo del pueblo.
I am not Mayan nor Guatemalan by heritage, yet somehow Guatemala feels like home to me. Maybe it reminds me of the Mexico I grew up in. But it is in this home that I found balance and a healing sanctuary, and where life's contrasts, like nature's beauty and its fury, like the reality of poverty and illness and crime, and the disparity between the rich and the poor are never far away, always in your face. And that daily realization makes me feel closer to reality, somehow more alive, more in tune with the rest of humanity. Viewing poverty on a regular basis, I feel more grateful for what I have. Viewing beauty amid sometimes harsh circumstances makes me appreciate it all the more as I gaze out at Agua, the volcano, and the clouds roll in.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors. Additional support for Latino USA is provided in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, supporting families, leading change.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to improve the accuracy and lessen the cost of voter registration at pewtrust.org, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org, and the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.